Well, Welcome, all. The last day of our Denkoe Sesshin, and the last talk, because we'll have a shorter afternoon and end by 3 o'clock. Yesterday we were talking a little about the Zen ancestor Sun Li and some of his teachings, including his model of sudden awakening followed by gradual cultivation or gradual practice. And this is how Sun Li puts it himself. Says, even though one suddenly realizes that the Dharmakaya, the true nature of mind, is identical with Buddha, still, for numberless eons, one has deludedly grasped the four elements as being oneself. So, you could say, physicality, materiality is the four elements. So I take this as for eons we've grasped the physical body as being ourself, our true self. So that this view has become second nature and it's very difficult to let go of all at once. One must practice on the basis of this realization of awakening, that the true nature of mind is Buddha. When one has reduced and further reduced this deluded view until there's nothing left of it, this is called attaining Buddhahood. It's a nice description of how one can have an insight, and that's my understanding of in these stories when they said the ancestor realized great awakening, and the character in every story is a Japanese Satori, which really just means to perceive or to understand or to realize. And I would understand they realized their Buddha nature, but usually these stories are kind of at the beginning of their practice, or not necessarily the beginning, but then they really get to work on their gradual practice. Cultivating, practicing on the basis of this realization. So like again and again, remembering. And Sun Li uses the beautiful image for this sudden and gradual. He says, like the wind over the ocean, the wind stops suddenly, but the waves keep rolling along after the wind stops. Isn't it? So it takes a long time for the waves to settle down, even though the wind has already stopped. Or his other metaphor is, the sun comes out suddenly, but the frost melts gradually. I think it's maybe a danger in Zen when somebody has some sudden insight into their true nature and it feels like, so now I'm done, everything's it. But they're neglecting these eons of habitual delusion, grasping materiality, physicality as being one's true self. And I could say, well, recently I asked one of my teachers something like, once we get this point, and of course there's I think also layers and layers of deepening all the nuances of Buddha nature, exploring all the qualities of Buddha nature, like its boundlessness, its edgelessness, its centerlessness, its beginninglessness, its endlessness, its unity with all appearances. All of these aspects we can clarify almost endlessly. But so there's deepening the clarification, and then there's the gradual aspect over time of what I think of sometimes as just remembering. Once we are pretty clear, then in the moment when we're clear, it's like actually everything's okay. There's all is at peace, even in the midst of chaos. But then, one moment later, we forget. And that the habit is much stronger to forget than to remember. So I asked this teacher, it was kind of a question about the gradual practice. How can we keep remembering and remembering and remembering? Is there any, trick to this? And he said, from a kind of conventional point of view, which is in a way what we're talking about with this gradual path, you can say it's just creating the conditions to remember. And he put it as hang around the right books and teachings and people that are on board with this practice. I mean, because we're totally influenced by our environment, and we're influenced by what we read, by what we watch on TV, we're influenced by every experience we're having. So he said, just, be careful what you read, actually, right? Even in terms of Buddha Dharma, I would say there's lots of teachings that are somewhat peripheral that are also useful and interesting and I think important. If we're making Buddha Dharma like our whole life, we get the whole range. But within that, there's certain teachings that are like really direct pointing teachings to our true nature. And in other traditions too, and to kind of spend more of our time with those teachings. And the Sangha, the community, the people, and the teachers that are trying to practice the same way. Right? Yes?
So, was regular contemplation practice be essential?
Yeah.
Yeah. Complete realization.
Yeah, we could add to the list of creating conditions to remember. This is a list of conditions for remembering. Besides teachings and people, is of course the practices themselves. Like zazen is so great because it's such a simple setting for contemplation and inquiry. Meditative inquiry is awareness present, and then exploring all the qualities of it. And of course, sesshin, which is basically just a lot of zazen, is, I feel like, especially a great gift. It's creating the conditions to be able to go even more deeply into it in a sustained and more in-depth way. So great. I think that's one reason you could say why we have sesshins. So, and all kinds of other practices, any kind of Dharma practices, really.
Contemplation different from sitting.
From sitting?
Yeah.
Well, you could say sitting.
Not conditioning thoughts from sitting. But there is a different level of that in contemplation.
Or maybe.
To be working with.
Yeah.
One aspect of a teaching.
Yeah.
Allowing.
Yeah. So in Buddhism, we talk about those two sides of meditation, shamatha and vipassana. So the shamatha part we emphasize a lot in Zen of just sit, be present with your experience, and don't meddle with your experience and let go. It's kind of like the shamatha side, and we need that. And then we also need the for the full awakening, we also need to really investigate deeply what's happening. Otherwise, these habits from eons past continue to just like lie latent in the restful sitting of calm abiding or shamatha. So both together, and how, you know, Zen doesn't really delineate these two so dualistically, because in fact they work together. I think there's one old Indian text that's talking about something like, I think it might say something like, what are the conditions for different stages of practice? Like, what are the conditions for the path of accumulation and preparation? And it's like basically practicing kindness, you know, finding a stable situation, hanging around good books and sangha and teachers and communities. And then what are the conditions for the path of direct seeing or insight? And the conditions is the unity of calm abiding and meditative insight or contemplation, the unity of calming and contemplation. So in union, that's when those two are in union, you could say the seeing is there. So then this teacher said, conventionally speaking, especially at first, we need to make an effort to create these conditions. And then he said, over time, though, we start to see that less effort is needed to remember. This question was about how do we remember. And because, he said, we always remember what we love. I thought this was a great teaching. It's like, if you're really just falling in love with somebody, you can't stop thinking about them all the time, and you make no effort to do this. So the mind naturally goes to what it loves and what is most, you know, enjoyable and peaceful and joyful. So over time, we start to realize that resting as the awareness is the most enjoyable way to be, more than even, you know, interesting entertainment types of joys. It starts to sink in more and more deeply that this, I love this realm. I'm basically in love with Buddha nature, deeply in love with Buddha nature, and then it's less and less effortful. We naturally remember, the mind just goes there because it wants to. Whereas at first, it's like, it seems like actually, when it's not that clear, it's like, well, why would I want to just sit there and be Buddha nature? I could, like, go to the movies. And in the end, too, of course, we don't want to separate these and say, you can't be aware of Buddha nature at the movies. Of course, we start extending it into every activity. It's like we go to the movie and we're watching the movie and really enjoying it. We're also watching the screen behind the really plain screen behind it at the same time, and enjoying the screen. So anyway, that's a little of that sudden and gradual that came to mind today. And another point about this Buddha nature, you know, Keizan is, it seems like every one of his stories, or every one of these ancestor awakening stories seems to be about opening to this ungraspable awareness of Buddha nature. That's really like Keizan's, his love affair, I think, is this particular approach. More than I would say Dogen. Dogen definitely has it too. But Dogen also takes more of like a straight up emptiness approach and explores different realms of Dharma. And but I feel like this transmission of light record is really celebrating the not just the emptiness of everything, but the empty awareness of Buddha nature. And we were talking, so the first story we had was about not knowing is a name for this Buddha nature. Another one is about, the next one, Kapimala, was about the ocean of Buddha nature. And this story of Nagarjuna is about the jewel of Buddha nature. It's like a wish-fulfilling jewel. And one point about this ungraspable yet radiant jewel. I was talking with somebody about how we can. I think it's easier to open to the sense of how this awareness has no edges or boundaries. We can feel a sense of spaciousness, spacious awareness. We can open to that. And this is still something we have to keep exploring. But we're talking about an unlocatable awareness. So of course it has no edges. And of course an unlocatable, ungraspable awareness also has no center. But I think this recognition of the centerlessness of awareness is more difficult to realize than the edgelessness. Theoretically, they would be the same. They would be like the same understanding. But in fact, it seems to me, and probably to most people, that awareness, even if it has no edges or boundaries, it seems to have a center located in a particular area. What would you say that is in your experience? What's that? Yeah, like the head, or sometimes the whole, this body or part of the body called the head.
I am the center of this infinite universe.
Yes. That's right, that's the problem, right? Yeah, and we might even call that sense of a center of balanced awareness something like solipsism. Which is, means like, I am the center of the universe. Only I am I, meaning like this located awareness. We might even say that the body is still a manifestation of awareness, but it's manifesting from this particular location. And I think when you say head, and sometimes then we connect it with the brain, but I think the reason we feel as if awareness emanating from the head is because the sense faculties are all gathered in the same, what we call, physical location. They appear in this physical location. And might say that this boundless awareness manifests itself as the unique sense consciousnesses, right? It comes through. And even people like Zen Master Linji would say, there's this single brightness of awareness. But in the eyes, we call it seeing. In the ears, we call it hearing. And in the, maybe even in the mind, we call it thinking and feeling. It's how it manifests. So the seeing, hearing, and thinking, I think maybe we talked about yesterday, is they're kinds of knowing, but they're somewhat limited kinds of knowing. That's why they're called sense consciousnesses. They're called divided knowing because they seem to have a faculty and an object, like an eye and a color, an ear and a sound. They seem to be divided in that way. And they seem to have a limited range, like the eye can't hear sounds and the ear can't see colors. So in that way, it's almost like there are limitations on the boundless awareness that has no limitations. And so part of what the limitations of awareness coming through these sense consciousnesses is this sense of location. Like it seems like the consciousness, the sense consciousnesses are happening like around the head, or almost like emanating from the head and the body. We might be able to move it down to say the heart, if we have a real like open heart, love feeling, like, you know, fourth chakra opening. We maybe feel like this is the center of awareness, but that's still located. Or even like my knee is just like, it's just throbbing with intense pain. Then it almost seems like this is the center of awareness. This is the body consciousness in a particular location. So this is why I think it's very, and it's been this way for countless eons, that awareness is, knows itself through a body and mind of a sentient being. So the body and mind of the sentient being is not the boundlessness of awareness. It's a kind of a limitation, or a narrowing of the awareness into this particular experience. So that's another way of looking at we feel like, well, awareness itself could have this center. It's just the center of awareness. It's the ungraspable center of awareness. But if we have a sense of it as a center in the body, then I would say we could call that an experience. And we're talking about awareness is just experiencing. And if we have a sense of the center, that's an experience. So that's an object of awareness. So this is where I think it's very hard to, just a moment, to release this sense of location of the center of awareness. And then I thought of, related to this, in this last, one of the other things I've appreciated in this last year is trying out these flotation tanks. They used to be called sensory deprivation tanks. And there's three of these businesses just in Santa Cruz alone. It's a little steep cost, but it's a little bit like a sauna or spa. I think people go to deeply relax because it's deeply relaxing. But related to this sense of the body and the sense faculties as a center, being in this flotation tank was an interesting experience, because that's what it's about. It's basically like taking all the sense faculties, the five sense faculties, and just turning them down as far as they'll go. So it's completely dark, it's completely soundless, and you have earplugs, so there's just not a trace of sound. There's no smell, there's no taste, and we think the body is the hardest one to have no sense faculty, but that's why it's this tank with, you know, very high density of salt water. So you're floating really high on the water, so you don't feel like you're kind of half sinking. It's just very comfortable. It's like a water bed or something, but there's no physical layer under the body. And so there, if you lay there for, you know, an hour or two, you really, my experience was really feeling like, of course, I'm meditating on this awareness. Really feels like now this is what it's like when awareness really doesn't have the boundaries of the or the limitations of the sense faculties. There's still thinking going on, but it's like the thinking is happening in this boundless dark space with no body. Even, you know, if we're pretty comfortable, if we have some aches and pains, it's a little maybe harder. So it was a nice way to get used to the sense of how awareness really doesn't need to have a center. And then at the end of this session, you know, lights start gradually coming on, and a little bit of music starts coming in, and you see, oh, it's like awareness is, it really has the feeling of awareness is suddenly manifesting anew as a human body with all these senses. And standing up, it's kind of like, it's like stepping out of space into a like a avatar or body or something. So it's kind of was a nice way to verify that awareness doesn't need this sense of center, but it usually does have the sense of center as a body, which is okay as long as we don't think that really is the center of awareness. It's more like the sense of location in the center is a manifestation of awareness. It's the display of awareness. It's made of awareness, the sense of center, but not separate from it, but it appears in this unique way, and then the way it gets so solidified is because this entire life, awareness is like kind of known through this particular body and mind, right? So, of course we identify with this body and mind as myself, and that's why, of course, it's no easy matter to disidentify with the body and mind as being my true nature and my true self, re-identify with the entirety of awareness that includes everything as my true self. And then this body is one expression of awareness, and this location, and then that location of these other bodies are also equal expressions of the same awareness. And that equality part, I think to get to the point where we really feel as if this body and mind is an equal expression of the same awareness as that body and mind, is no small matter. I think we can glimpse it for a moment, but as soon as we start interacting, I think we just fall right back into, I gotta take care of this one first. We've been deeply trained, not even in this lifetime, Buddhist story, for countless eons.
Evolution.
Yes.
Survival.
Yeah, it really set us up, yeah, I think the Dalai Lama once said something like, he's like, Dharma on its deepest level is undoing our evolutionary setups. This is quite radical. Yes, did you have a question?
I was just observing that when you define the core, when you define the center.
Yeah.
It seems like we probably create restrictions and limitations about the vastness of the scope of the space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what it is.
And you do that because the core really is dynamic and it can shift and move around depending on what your perception is. You were talking about
say we're really into looking at something. It's like almost like our self is focused on the visual, and then suddenly a bee stings our knee, and almost like our self goes or moves location.
Awareness,
yeah.
So, I mean, if you take that and gather that remembering, the question that you were asking your teacher brought up something for me about when the Dharma was created and was realized, and as it's been transmitted over time, the question about, your teacher said be careful about what you read and surround yourself with Sangha and like-minded people and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But when I visualize what the implication of that, and how different it is now that we're all so interconnected, and you can, not only is it true that nature, Buddha nature, is everything,
but
we can now experience so much more of it.
Through like internet and communication,
rituals, cultures, imprints that come mm-hmm. from everywhere.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So, but it seems like, my perception mm-hmm. is that so many sanghas have an absence of diversity. Mm-hmm. I mean, just look around.
Seriously. You mean like racial diversity?
Every kind of diversity. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're all
economic.
White and, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, we can mm-hmm. take time off from whatever mm-hmm. it is. It's a very, mm-hmm. So what your teacher mm-hmm. said, it's curious to me. I don't think
he meant necessarily like, you know, the members of your Zen center. I thought he didn't even, and in fact, this teacher wasn't even a Buddhist teacher. So that's already an example of me going outside of the limited Zen sangha, but like-minded. Yeah. So like-minded doesn't have to be within any special tradition. Hopefully, we can find it and we're drawn to certain traditions. But yeah, it can be anywhere and any race and any ritual. And everywhere, yeah. But, and in the ultimate sense, it everything is it. But you could say those who never aren't, those who don't have this love affair with awareness, and they're actually causing lots of harm in the world, and they're really harmful to other beings. You could say, even though they're also it, because it's everywhere. I think the recommendation is, conventionally speaking, trying not to spend that much time with those who are like going in a completely different direction. So I think there's some, we can make these, you know, discernments, but it's not limited to Buddhism or Zen. Yeah. Yeah. Tibetan, you know, we have the Rime movement is like ecumenical, movement where there's, within every Buddhist country, there's all these different lineages, and things can get very sectarian. And there was this movement in the 1800s in Tibetan Buddhism of like people feeling like, we're getting too sectarian. There's these beautiful teachings in all these other traditions. It was still within Buddhism because I don't think there was any other religion except for maybe Bun in Tibet. And they were included in the Rime ecumenical, they call it non-sectarian, the non-sectarian movement. So I think we can expand that beyond even Buddhism. Patrick and I this next week are going to go to the Science and Non-Duality Conference, where there's hardly any mention of Buddhism, but it's people who are definitely into exploring these same types of knowing. Through the world of science. It's not even religion at all. Yeah.
I didn't hear you talk about when we're locating awareness as we experience the subtle body.
Oh, yeah.
And his...
yeah.
I know Zen doesn't talk that much about it, but...
The subtle body.
My experience of that awareness, and I don't know which comes first.
Yeah.
It's like a whole body experience, but I also feel it simultaneously, you know, in the channel.
Yeah, so subtle body is like kind of yogic body, and it's not so emphasized in Zen, but very much part of Indian, Hindu, Vedanta, yoga, Tibetan Buddhism. Meaning like, and also qigong.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So it's the body of qi and the body of prana and the channels through which it runs and the vortices of congealed energy in the central channel. And so in a way, maybe just without getting all into it too much, maybe we could say that that's like this so-called subtle body is not a physical body, but and it's not. I guess we do say it has location, but it's almost like it's a bridge, I would say, between unlocatable awareness and the gross material body, something like in between. I don't know what Chinese medicine would say, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, in the Chinese medicine texts that we've inherited in the last half a century, they don't make much mention of those, but the medical Qigong tradition, newly named, that comes from Taoism, will talk about the Taiji pole, which is the central channel that we're just talking about, and sort of like phenomenologically or experientially moving from, let's say, the nose or the front part of the body, like toggling your awareness back, seemingly backwards, into the feeling and spaciousness of the central channel. You start to kind of dissolve that sense of center in a way. It's like you're kind of dissolving backwards or walking backwards into that spaciousness that has no edges. And so that sense of center becomes less tangibly felt.
Almost like through opening to or as the central channel, we open to the unlocatable awareness.
Yeah, and it's the Tao that's sort of
I think, yeah.
The body in that way. But this bridge, I think, the energetic bridge between that and the physicality.
Yeah.
It works nicely, like with the three bodies of Buddha, right?
Ah. Yeah. This is kind of like the bliss body.
Yeah.
And I think that was a nice, I have heard also Tibetan Buddhist tradition can also speak of this, the central channel, very strangely gets spoken of as the nature of mind, and which doesn't make sense rationally, but I think it's just like you said it, I think, in a very nice way, that's really what it is. So another thing about location is we chanted this morning in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, the beautiful line, you are not it, in truth it is you. I think is a nice way to if we feel like I, in this located body, am it meaning the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, the awareness itself. But Dongshan says, actually, it's not that you, as this person, are it. It, in truth, is you. So it's manifesting a location rather than emanating from a location.
There's a little bit of Dogen when he says something like, you do not carry forth the self.
To carry yourself forward and confirm the myriad things is delusion. Then the myriad things coming forth and confirming yourself is awakening. Yeah, it is like that.
I couldn't hear you, Patrick. No, I was just kind of liking that it's similar intent this idea of Dogen's to carry yourself forward is an experience of the world is delusion, that the world comes to you with enlightenment.
Uh-huh. In that case, Dogen means the undivided self in the second part.
I think we could hear it that way, yeah. I think you could explore it in both ways, the limited self or the undivided self. To carry your limited, small ego self forward and confirm things like, I know what that is, that's delusion. And then maybe we could say in the second line, the myriad things coming forth, confirming your true self is awakening. The only hesitation I sometimes have about that line to really, as the best clarification for what we're talking about now, I sometimes wonder, because then it sounds like the myriad things are what's real. and they're coming forth. There's no self, but they're coming forth and making us. Whereas that's a little bit, from this model, it's more like the myriad things are myself. Maybe that's a way to understand it. But if we start thinking the myriad things are real, though I'm just like being created by those real things, I think that's sometimes how I've heard it in the past. Now I would feel like that's not quite right. Do you know what I mean?
Can you repeat the thing before what I said one more time?
The first line?
You are not it.
Oh, you are not it. In truth, it is you. Or in reality, it is you. Yes.
Yeah. Could you say, let's see, when there are no centers, when there is no center, is that the same thing as saying there are centers everywhere?
Yeah. Well, we could say center. Yeah. Well, centers are manifestations or expressions of awareness. So in that way, yeah, there's centers everywhere. Awareness is expressing itself as like infinite centers, we could call them locations. Awareness is unlocated awareness is expressing itself as all these infinite locations, and in each location, that from the perspective of that location, it is the center.
Almost seems like fizzy water or something. Even with like the ocean metaphor, it's like carbonated ocean.
Concentrated bits of energy.
Yeah.
Mm.
But it seems to me engaging too deeply with that metaphor means to identify particular things as having a center, like the atom, which, when the atom isn't really divisible from other things, or you can go the other way and say the atom could be divided even further.
Yeah. I think conceptually you're right, but like experientially for me, that feels like ecstatic. It takes me away from the sense of center. Mm-hmm. You know, assuming that we're composed of atoms or however much you want to divide those down into the component parts, I think like as opposed to it being this way that we think about it, for me, if I approach it from more of a viewing standpoint, it doesn't have the same contraction in my experience.
And I didn't think Andrew was saying that the true centers are atoms. I heard him saying that like everything is a center, including atoms, but actually even big things are centers too. You know, a beach ball is just as much a center as the atoms that make up the beach ball. At least that's how I was hearing it. We don't want to like start saying that atoms are these partless particles that make up the universe and they're like the true centers. Buddhism actually kind of went through that, kind of got over that issue by not finding partless particles. But then you could say there definitely is the appearance of atoms and appearance, even mathematically appearance of all kinds of stuff. But if we say there's some real building block, then we've lost the view of, like, actually, the only real building block is the non-located boundless awareness. It's not quite a block. So, the 14th Zen ancestor in India was Venerable Nagarjuna. Once the 13th ancestor, Kapimala, paid a visit at the request of a Naga king and received a wish-fulfilling jewel. Chintamani, the wish-fulfilling jewel, or a Nyoi jewel. Nyoi. This thing is called a Nyoi, or a Chinta, I guess in Sanskrit. It means like, it's In Chinese, actually, or in Japanese, it means as you wish, as you like it. It's kind of the sense of wish fulfilling. E is kind of like intention or thought. So as you think, so it is another way of translating this. Nyo-e. as you intend, as you think, as you wish. It's part of the Buddhist story of these wish-fulfilling jewels and wish-fulfilling cows that, like, give endless milk, soy milk, and wish-fulfilling trees that give endless fruit. Or wish-fulfilling... Cool. I want one of those. Okay. Master Nagarjuna asked his teacher Kapimala, "This jewel is the best in the world. Does it have form, or is it formless, or does it have really this word so means like characteristics or signs?" Does it have signs or characteristics, or is it signless? Kapimala said, "You just understand having characteristics and not having characteristics, but you don't understand that this jewel neither has characteristics nor has no characteristics, nor do you understand that this jewel is not a jewel." Hearing this, Nagarjuna was deeply awakened. It sounds like the kind of thing that Nagarjuna would later say to him.
Neither this nor that.
Yeah.
Neither both nor
yeah.
That.
Like that. That was his awakening. He said, "Is this..." He was already getting into, like, is this jewel, like, yeah, have some graspable characteristics or not? And he was into that, is it this way or that way? And Kapimala wanted to go deeper and said, "You just understand these two possibilities, but you don't understand that it has neither this characteristics nor not these characteristics." And that deepening awakened Nagarjuna. And that it's not a jewel, actually. Lex Hickson, in his interpretation, says, when Nagarjuna says, "Does it have form or is it formless?" Kapimala said, "You're still obsessed with parallel logic structures. You understand this, you know, having form or not having form, but you don't understand neither having form nor no form." That was a nice, like, little commentary interpretation. You're obsessed with parallel logic structures, almost the duality of, does it have form or not? And so Kapimala says, it's not really a matter of this or that. It's neither this nor that. Nagarjuna was from Western India and was also named Naga Greatness and Naga Excellence. You know, Nagas are those serpents, snake-like serpents of India that live in the water. In Chinese, they just translate it as dragon. The character for dragon. At this time, Kapimala, the 13th ancestor, having become a monk and having been transmitted the true Dharma, traveled to Western India. There was a prince named Megashvara, or free as clouds. And he respected Kapimala and invited him to his palace, where he made offerings to him. But Kapimala said, the Tathagata taught that a Buddhist shramana, or like a mendicant, should not approach the dwellings of rulers and ministers and politicians and other powerful people. The Buddha kind of, this goes back to this practical advice of like, be careful who you hang around with. the prince said, "Well, okay, you don't have to hang around me, because I was gonna like entice you with all kinds of worldly treasures and the all the distractions of the palace life here. So you're probably right; you shouldn't hang around me. But actually, there's a big mountain north of this city, and on the mountain there's a stone cave. Would you like to practice meditation there?" Kapimala said he would like that. So, after a few miles, he reached the mountain, and there he encountered a huge snake. He continued ahead without paying any attention, but the snake slithered up behind him, approached, and wrapped itself around him. But then Kapimala conferred the three treasures on the snake, and when the snake heard the refuges, he left. As Kapimala was about to enter the cave, an old man wearing plain white clothes appeared from the cave and greeted him with palms joined. Kapimala asked, "Where do you live?" The old man answered, "Long ago I was a monk who enjoyed solitude very much and lived in remote mountain forests. Once in a while, novice monks would come asking for instruction, but I felt it was a nuisance to answer them. They were disturbing my peace, and I got angry. So when I died, I was reborn as a huge snake. Now I've lived in this cave for 1,000 years since. But since I met you, Kapimala, and I've been able to take refuge in the three treasures, now I'm free and I've come to thank you." He'd kind of turned into a person again. And thanking him. Hearing this, Kapimala said, "Do any other people live in these mountains?" And the old man said, "Several miles north of here, there's a big tree that shelters 500 great Nagas. The name of their leader is Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna. He's always preaching the Dharma to the Nagas, and I listen." Kapimala finally visited him with his followers. Nagarjuna appeared and greeted Kapimala, saying, "The deep mountains are lonely and still, a place where great serpents dwell. Why do you, a great sage, venerable one, turn your venerable feet in this direction of these lonely mountain hideaways?" Kapimala said, "I'm not the most venerable. I've come here to visit a virtuous person." Nagarjuna thought to himself, "Has this teacher attained certainty and clarified his Dharma eye? Is he a great sage who perpetuates the Mahayana, great vehicle?" And Kapimala said, he read his mind and said, "Even though you're just thinking that thought, I already know what you're thinking. So don't worry about whether I'm a sage or not. Just be clear about leaving home or renunciation or letting go. Don't get caught up in judging how wise I am. Just do your work, let go. Literally leave home." Hearing this, Nagarjuna apologized and left home. Kapimala liberated him and ordained him as a monk, and the 500 Nagas also received the full precepts as a group. Subsequently, Nagarjuna followed Kapimala for 4 years, and then they had this interaction about the jewel. However, people think, now this is Kazon commenting, people think Nagarjuna was not only the 14th Zen ancestor, but he was also the ancestral teacher of various other traditions. Shingon and Tendai also consider him to be one of their original ancestors, as do Yin Yang diviners, silk producers, and others. So I think it's true that in all of East Asia, in China and Japan and Korea, they all have their interlineage, basically. And they all have to have a lineage that goes back to Buddha. And I think they all include Nagarjuna as one of their Indian ancestors. I know that it's interesting to kind of study where our Zen Indian ancestors came from. And there's some sutras that are like pre-Zen sutras that talk about this lineage of Indian ancestors maybe they were written in China, but like I know the Tendai lineage is almost identical. It's basically all the same as our Zen lineage up to like the last few before Bodhidharma. And I guess Shingon, which is the Vajrayana school of Japan, is also Nagarjuna is an ancestor. Yin-yang diviners are like, I don't know what they are. Ever heard of that, Andrew? So I guess in old China there was like, fortune tellers that somehow measured the yin and yang of people to tell their fortune. And they had, Nagarjuna was one of their ancestors. And silk producers. There's some lineage of silk producers of which Nagarjuna is an ancestor. He's the author of a whole bunch of stuff. He's like, super important Mahayana teachings of the middle way and emptiness. And of course Tibetan Buddhism too, Nagarjuna is super important. So all of Mahayana Buddhism is, considers Nagarjuna one of their great, ancestors. And, he's one of these, of our Indian ancestors that we actually do know quite a bit about her through his writings. All about how, because this depends on this, this has no independent existence. It's totally empty of independent existence. That's Nagarjuna's shtick. And very intricately and beautifully, fleshes that teaching out. So Keizan says, these are all arts that Nagarjuna practiced in the past, but when he became the 14th Zen ancestor, he abandoned them all. Even though students of these arts say that Nagarjuna was their original ancestor. That's a little sectarian, right? He's saying, he's really our ancestor. He's just a Zen. Once he got the Zen thing, he forgot, Shingon, Tendai. It's like, that's like, been there, done that. I'm going to pass on the Zen lineage now. So I think it's beautiful that Nagarjuna is part of all these traditions, including the Zen lineage. So Nagarjuna, when Kapimala, his teacher, was hanging out with the Nagas, the Naga king. So together, Kapimala and Nagarjuna hanging out with the Nagas. Also, that's where Nagarjuna got his name. And there's a story of that the Prajnaparamita Sutras were, when the Buddha taught them, he felt like people, at this time are not yet ready for this radical emptiness teaching. So let's hide them under the ocean in the palace of the Nagas. And they'll protect them until the time is right to reveal them. And then Nagarjuna was the one who started hanging out with the Nagas, and they started showing them these sutras, and Nagarjuna was like, the time is right, let's bring them out, and I'll comment on them. So, in this story, Kapimala and Nagarjuna practicing together with the Nagas, and one of the Naga kings gave this wish-fulfilling jewel to Kapimala. And, Nagarjuna said, this is the best jewel in the world. And the jewel, could say is, Buddha nature. But it's manifesting as a warm jewel. It's warm and then it's like emanates love and compassion. Nagarjuna said, does it have signs, characteristics, form, or is it signless? In fact, Keizan says, Nagarjuna understood right from the beginning. Considering it to have form or not form is just attachment to the extreme views of existence and non-existence. It's a little bit like, that's maybe where Lex Hickson got that. Is even to talk about these two are just getting into the duality of signless and having signs. existence and non-existence. It was for precisely this reason that Kapimala spoke as he did. In fact, even if it's an ordinary jewel, when you speak from the standpoint of truth, it neither has signs or lack signs. It's just a jewel. Kapimala said, this jewel is not a jewel, but Kazan here in his style says, even if it's not like Buddha nature jewel, if it's just an ordinary worldly jewel, still from the standpoint of reality, it neither has signs nor lack signs. And it's not a jewel, but then Kazan says, it's just a jewel. Boundless awareness manifests a location as a particular wish-fulfilling jewel with a certain characteristic and weight. How much less is the jewel suspended from the wrestler's forehead, the jewel wound up in the ruler's turban or topknot, the jewel under the chin of the dragon king, and the jewel hidden in the clothes of the drunken man, connected with what people think the jewel is. So these are all these Buddhist stories about jewels, and Kazan's saying all these stories, though they're great Buddhist metaphors, that's just they're limited by the conceptual stories of them, and I don't know all of them, but the drunken man story is from the Lotus Sutra. Yeah, that the two friends, and one of them, they're hanging out together, drinking buddies, and one of them gets really drunk and passes out, his friend knows that he's quite poor, and he maybe doesn't have it. They're maybe traveling, and he doesn't have anywhere to stay. So he's like feeling kind of sympathy for him, and says, "I'm going to take this very valuable jewel I have, and I'm going to sew it into the clothing of this passed out drunk, so that he'll have this resource for when he sobers up. He can go get a hotel room." And I'm sewing it in the clothing so that nobody will, if I just put it in his pocket, maybe somebody would steal it. So it's kind of like it's there with him, and he'll find it. And then he leaves. And of course, the drunken man wakes up and goes wandering around, destitute, even though he has his precious jewel sewn into his clothing. He doesn't know about it. It's kind of hidden in his clothing. That's something like that, the Lotus Sutra story. And I think Dogen says, in Dogen has a fascicle called The One Bright Jewel. And in that, I think he says, this is the jewel of Buddha nature. And Dogen saying, this jewel is sewn into our clothing when we're drunk. Sorry, referring to the Lotus Sutra. And meaning like, when we're deluded and kind of unconscious and confused, actually, Buddha nature is like is permeating us at this very time of drunken confusion. This jewel is sewn into our clothes. I think Dogen maybe even says the jewel is always sewn in. It's always sewn into our clothes when we're drunk. It's not like when we're really clear, we get the jewel. So this is about kind of non-duality too, right? In a very poetic, Dogen-like way. It's only when we're confused that Buddha nature permeates our clothing. Because we're always kind of confused. So anyway, is the wrestler's forehead, is that the Lotus Sutra? Do you remember anything like that? Maybe it's the Sharangama Sutra. Anyway, keep an eye out for the jewel in the wrestler's forehead. Can't quite remember, but even these stories metaphors for Buddha nature.
What's the one about the chin under the dragon?
Oh yeah, there's a story that the dragons, these ungraspable dynamic beings, have this wish fulfilling jewel like tucked under their chin. So if you want to get this jewel, you gotta take a risk. These dragons are, you know, breathing fire and flipping their flippers around. So how to take the jewel from under the dragon's chin.
So kind of like a metaphor for session.
Yeah. Like that. Yeah. The jewel is tucked into all this incessant zazen and tedious.
It's not so easily got. You have to sit for sometimes 3 full days.
And maybe the metaphor is also like, if you want this jewel, you can't go about it roughly. You wait till the dragon's really like kind of resting asleep, and you very gently go up and you say, excuse me. You don't go in there like, hey, if you go, hey, I'm going to take your jewel, they just breathe fire all over you. So it's difficult to decide whether these jewels have signs or lack signs. However, the above-mentioned jewels are ordinary jewels and not at all the supreme jewel of the way, which I thought it's interesting. The jewel that's hidden in the drunken man's clothes is an ordinary jewel, even though I think it's meant to be a metaphor for like Buddha nature that will fulfill all wishes. So I would understand, say these ones are ordinary jewels, I would say because they're just metaphors. I think that's what Kazan's getting at. It's a metaphor for the real jewel, but because they're just metaphors, they can be talked about, they're not the real jewel. How can anyone know that this jewel is also not a jewel? This must be clarified carefully. Xuan Sha said, the whole body is a jewel. Who should I tell about this? Right? The entire reality is a jewel. Who can I tell? He also said, the whole universe in 10 directions is one bright jewel. Truly, this cannot be discriminated with the views of humans and celestials. However, even if it's an ordinary jewel, it does not come from outside, but rather appears totally from within the mind of true self. Therefore, Chakra Indra, the Lord of the Heavens, uses it as a wish-fulfilling jewel or mani jewel. If you receive and use, this is Juyu, as in Jijuyu means to receive and use, but together means to enjoy. If you receive and use or enjoy this jewel when you're ill, the illness is cured. If you wear this jewel when you're worried, the worry will dissipate on its own. Using this jewel, one also manifests supernatural powers and magical transformations. When one's own original mind is revealed, or when the mind of the true self is revealed, it becomes this fathom-long body. That's what we were talking about, right? It becomes, the capital M, mind of our true self, becomes this fathom-long body, or a figure with 3 heads, or animal forms with horns and hair, and an infinite variety of other forms. Nevertheless, you must discern this mind jewel. Do not seek solitude and hide yourselves in mountain forests like monks long ago. People who were not fully awakened made this mistake in earlier times. People who have not attained the way still make this mistake. People think that being around others and being involved in various activities prevents them from becoming tranquil, so they want to live alone in mountain forests and do zazen alone, practicing the way quietly. saying this, many live in obscurity in mountains and valleys, mistakenly cultivating and polishing themselves, and thus many enter into false paths. The reason for this is that they do not understand what the truth or reality is, and they vainly put themselves first. Kazan now, like, goes on this rant for pages about living alone, practicing alone. It's interesting. It's kind of like, he went to the jewel story, and now he's, because of this, the story took place in this remote mountain forest, and about that monk who got angry when somebody disturbed him by asking him questions. He said, we should not practice like that. We should practice together. And I read this story decades ago, and in my youthful gung-ho days, when I had dreams to go off into the forest and practice alone, like living at Tassajara. I felt like it was too distracting just to live it in the community at Tassajara, amongst practitioners, too busy. And there were friends of mine who went off alone. It was the times or something. Another young man named Patrick, who was, as a friend of mine, also had that aspiration. He got permission from the practice committee of Tassajara to do a whole 3-month practice period, or two of them actually, alone in the Tassajara wilderness, and to actually use Tassajara as like a place he could come in on full moons and replenish his rice, which he just, I think, cooked on a fire out there. Kind of amazing that they supported their, it was, you know, there was some discussion about this, but like, we see you really want to do this and we want to support you, but it was a little bit like Kazan. We actually think you haven't been practicing that long, actually. We think you should actually do some more practice periods with this annoying community. A little bit longer. And eventually he left. So I, when I read this, I thought, I felt Kazan's admonitions hit me and feel like I understand what he's saying, and it is somewhat selfish of me to want to go practice alone. And I still have aspirations to do more solitary retreat, but not like forever. And Zen tradition, of course, has a hermit tradition too, especially in China. But interestingly, by this point in Japan, Dogen and Kazan were really into like kind of really discouraging hermit practice. And I think for us now, we can say, I think it applies to us now. It's like we do practice alone. I think it's good to get used to practicing at one's home alone. But I think it's also good to practice with community, especially because, you could say, partly because of this earlier point that hanging around like-minded people reminds us, but also it's even better when the community is really annoying. Then it's really valuable to practice with because it's too easy to practice alone. That's what I actually find. That's why I like doing that alone thing. You get really settled and really quiet. But I love practicing together. It's like,
even if you try to go on, nature will find a way.
Nature will find a way, yes indeed.
Your story about the dog coming.
That's right. That's right. The one dog night. Yeah, nature will find a way. We're never really alone. It's impossible to actually be alone, because there's always animals around, and they will relate to us in mountain caves and
dragons
too, yeah, yes. But I think humans are especially good to practice with. And and in case I'm saying particularly you know, know, before being really clear what the practice is. And some of the times when I was thinking about Atasahara, when I look back at it now, I was like, I wasn't that clear what the practice was actually. I mean, I knew how to be still and quiet, but it was like, I wanted to just be still and quiet, and that's not the whole practice. So, then Keizan says, well, I know some of you people say, quote these old Zen ancestors who, like Dame and Guishan, who cultivated the way in the clouds and mists with tigers and wolves for companions. And you say, we also should practice this way, shouldn't we? And Keizan says, this is truly laughable. You must realize that these ancients all realized the way and received authentication from a true teacher before they went out to the wilds. For a while they practiced alone in the mountains in this way in order to mature their understanding while awaiting the right conditions for offering their teaching. That is a kind of classic thing in Zen and other Buddhist traditions too, that the sixth ancestor was like this. He had this awakening with his teacher in the community, and then he snuck off, right, in the middle of the night, and then he lived with his hunters in the wilderness for, I think, 6 years or something, a long time, and they say he wasn't ready to yet come out and teach the Platform Sutra. The conditions weren't quite right, so he kind of went into seclusion, knowing he would come back out, kind of maturing his understanding in a concentrated way. I think there's even this Chinese Zen term of something like maturing the embryo of sagehood refers to this, it's just like Sun Mi's, after a sudden realization, clarification, being really clear what practice and realization is, then maturing this embryo, often alone before, offering the jewel. So, but Keizan, even though this is a Zen tradition, Keizan says, especially before this, understanding also, Guishan and Dame had received the true seal from their teachers, and the Dharma transmission and the understanding was clear. So they were able to do that, but even if it's clear, it's best to practice in community. If it's not clear, then the people who practice alone become Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas and destroy the seed of Buddhahood. In other words, they're not practicing with great compassion for all beings. They're for their own enlightenment. Therefore, people train carefully in monastery. Thomas Cleary translates it as community. Sōrin literally means a forest thicket, which is a poetic name for a Zen monastery, but it means a forest of a bunch of people, practitioners. Practice a long time with the spiritual teacher, completely clarify the great matter of birth and death, and finish clarifying your true self. As for deepening the roots later for a while and strengthening the stem, this is this nurturing the embryo, maturing the embryo, deepening the roots and strengthening the stem later, solidifying your realization, even though you be a successor of former generations of ancestors. In our own Soto lineage, our founder, Eihei Dogen, has admonished us against practicing alone. This is so people would not stray onto the wrong path. In particular, our late master Kohon Edyo has said, my disciples should not live alone. Even if you have attained the way, you should train in the community. How much less should those still engaged in study and practice before realizing the way live alone? Those who ignore this admonition do not belong to our tradition. So I hear this, I take this to heart as someone who dreams of practicing more solitary retreat, and I probably will, and I take it as it's okay to do it some, but I think this means like to forever or even for a really long time. It's like this world needs practitioners to infiltrate the stormy ocean waves of delusion. See, it's almost time to stop.
How long were you talking about?
On and off a couple of different times. Maybe like 8 years or so total. And then Green Gulch Farm for about the same. Yeah. I love, it's a very romantic thing, I think, the hermit tradition. I think many people would say, well, that's actually much harder than community practice, to make it alone out in the wilderness. But I think the people who end up there are the ones who feel like, actually, that's the easier way. that actually is to really... And the Sesshin, in a way, is a time where we face the wall and focus on our own practice without much communication. So in a way, it's sort of like that. And we see the great value in silence and simplicity, right? From a Buddha nature perspective, if we really feel like I can only manifest my Buddha nature when there's not much stuff happening, that's a very limited view of Buddha nature, right? Because everything is Buddha nature. And totally annoying people and circumstances are just as much Buddha nature as the forests and streams, right? Equally expressions of. So remembering this, then I heard there was where the Tibetan tradition, the often practitioners will do these 3-year retreats, usually very secluded, sometimes cemented into a room, so they're sure not to leave or see anyone. But I heard there's one contemporary teacher did their 3-year retreat. They went to like a big city in probably Tibet, and right at like a really busy intersection in the crossroad street, there was a little clearing, and they sat there for 3 years. The cars honking all over, and like, wow, that person was really like had some understanding of Buddha nature. Cool, huh?
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure that there are different setups for 3-year retreats, but the POL, they're practicing community.
Yeah, that's right. There's versions that are with others, alone some of the day, and done rituals together,
yeah.
And so on. Yeah, yeah. Middle way. Yeah, between the city crossroads and totally alone. Maybe we could do a Sesshin next year on Pacific Avenue. And Bernie Glassman does these, right? Street retreats.
Well, there's the Wisdom Center down there. It's pretty close.
Yeah. But maybe there are some hidden yogis actually doing retreat on the streets of Santa Cruz. They're part of the institution of Santa Cruz. You see them, and we don't know if they're hidden sages or just crazy. Today I have some humble words to say concerning this story. Do you want to hear them?
Yeah.
the solitary light, aware space, is always free from darkness. The wish-fulfilling mani jewel shines everywhere. Thanks for your presence and patience and attention in this session. We dedicate the merit of our gathering together with like-minded people to all beings everywhere of like and unlike minds. May they all receive the radiance of our collective wish-fulfilling jewel. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.